Welcome to another Innovation Forum podcast with me, Ian Welsh. Today I'm joined by Jia Chakrabarty from the TISC Report. Welcome, Jia.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
We're going to be talking a little bit about the work of the TISC Report and compliance in modern slavery reporting in general. So, Jia, why don't you start us off by giving us some background to TISCReport.org, why it was set up and what it aims to do.
Sure. So TISC Report stands for Transparency in Supply Chains Report. And it was set up originally to measure compliance with Section 54 of the Modern Slavery Act. What it's turned into is the world's largest open data transparency in supply chains register. So what that means is that it links open transparency data with shared and siloed data, so what we now call white box to black box. Critically, it holds the largest data set for compliance and non-compliance with Section 54, and even more compliance data with a growing number of related non-financial regulations.
That's what it does. What are its aims?
Our aims are to drive modern slavery, labour exploitation, corruption out of supply chain.
Short and sweet. Okay. What are the trends then you're seeing in reporting, particularly around the necessary statements for the UK's Modern Slavery Act?
We've been in the privileged position of watching the birth and development of a new regulation, which is Section 54, one that requires annual reporting, but does not have a place on gov.uk or a government-run site. So we've been seeing behaviours that you probably wouldn't see ordinarily. So if you were going to look at how companies are reporting, then the trends can be classified very similar to those seen in technology adoption. So you can have the innovators, and in this case, for the Modern Slavery Act, it's the retailers that led the way, and they, in fact, were the ones who joined forces with the NGOs and said, we need Section 54. We need to ensure that there's an even playing field for us to be able to tackle exploitation in supply chains transparently without feeling that we are going to be singled out. And in that group, you would have found, you know, Tesco, Marks & Spencer, BT's, and the big, big groups who have been helping to drive forward transparency. And then if you look at early adopters, well, these are usually big brands, B2Cs, quite often well-resourced compliance departments, usually very visible in the marketplace and understand what they need to do in terms of creating a document that meets at least, at the very least, standards that they want to push out for consumers and their buyers and customers alike. The early majority, those are at the smaller end perhaps, but still have compliance and legal resource in-house. They also may have customers or clients who are in higher risk sectors who have the potential for reputational damage. So they adopt fairly early after the early adopters so that they can reassure their buyers, their customers, that they are meeting those requirements for them. Then you move on to the late majority who are more than likely to have external legal counsel. They do make use of it, but you may not see the quality of statement that you would want. And finally, of course, you've got the laggards. And I don't mean this in a derogatory sense. It's sort of like the way that you look at how technology is adopted, you can apply to how well a piece of regulation that has been adopted within a company. These companies are those that, this is not a rule, but generally we've been seeing that they have little experience in compliance. They may be working with very low margins. They may not respond to calls for regulation or meeting their obligations without some external incentive or encouragement or threat. And they will have delegated their responsibility to very junior members of staff. As we've seen in terms of the discussions that we've had, they haven't been given any legal guidance to speak of, so they're in the dark.
More specifically then, what are the sort of reasons that you're seeing for non-compliance with what is in the face of it a pretty straightforward piece of legislation?
It's straightforward, but also it's complicated because it's not structured in any way. So you can't tick box and say, I've met everything that was there. And it's not a financial regulation, and financial side of things tend to be much more attended to. When you look at non-financial and free-form reporting, it leaves people in a bit of a quandary about what they report, whether or not something that they report could put their company at risk. We've seen various different reasons. We have, over the course of the last few years, spoken to many different types of organisation about why they may not have complied. Some of them ask outright, is there a fine? Has someone been fined for not complying? And we've had to say, well, not yet. There is a mechanism within Section 54 to apply unlimited fines and court injunctions to force you to comply. But actually, until I can come up with a case, they're not really interested. Then there are those who genuinely were lost and didn't know quite how to approach it. And they haven't been given the resource to be able to meet that compliance requirement properly. And that nervousness makes them worry about submitting something. We have been able to point statements at them within their sector to give them a little bit of encouragement on how others have done it. But even then, This is a new piece of regulation. This is not something that people are used to. And so there's a huge reticence and a lack of skill.
Sure. I mean, I guess there's still the element of this being very new for many companies. And for many companies in particular, transparency is something which goes against their culture. What sort of sectoral trends are you seeing then, given that this is still a new thing for so many companies? Are there any particular sectors that are doing well, and who are the sectors that are doing badly? And are there any surprises?
So we at Discoport have been tracking by SIC code. SIC code, as you know, is not a very satisfactory way of tracking what's happening within sectors, but is the best that we've got based on the fact that we're tracking data within companies' health. Not all companies have SIC code, so this isn't an exhaustive thing, it's a qualitative thing, but we have been tracking from March 2018 through to the deadline that was placed March 2019 by the Home Office in their most recent letter to businesses that they felt were in scope. So if we look at March last year, you were looking at sectors that didn't feel that they had anything to do with modern slavery, not realizing they had to comply. That was arts, entertainment and recreation. You also had education sector thinking that it didn't apply to them. So that was a non-compliance rate of 70% within that SIC code. Then you look at mining and quarrying, interestingly, which you'd have thought would have been very aware, but there was a real reticence a year ago to produce statements. And we had one interesting case where we were talking to a company group that is based in the UK that owned several mining companies in South Africa. And although they had the right turnover, they were adamant that, well, actually their legal team were adamant that they didn't need to comply because they weren't trading in the UK. So there was a understandable nervousness about putting something in writing when they were not sure or potentially didn't know what was going on and didn't want to report. So there are other service activities also that didn't feel that they were in scope. So there was a 67% non-compliance level there. Moving into March this year, which was the deadline, a lot of these sectors have upped their game. So the average non-compliance level is now at 23% average based on zip codes. But even then, you can look at education sector still very poor. Even though the SIC code for agriculture, forestry and fishing has a very low number of companies over those 6 million. So there's only about 90 of them there. But their compliance level has gone down.
Fine. Just to clarify, just for our listeners, in case they're not aware, the codes that you mentioned, those are UK Companies House, so the UK National Government Register of Businesses. They are the classification of sectoral codes. Is that correct?
That's right, yes. And it is well known that it is no longer the best measure, but it's the only measure that we've got based on what is recorded in Companies House. And it's self-reporting.
Obviously, we're moving from a compliance with a statement in the UK Modern Slavery Act initially, but there's a general move that's come up at our conference last month in London on modern slavery and forced labour issues. The move towards a more of a due diligence approach for company reporting on modern slavery and forced labour issues. How do you think that's going to change attitudes towards transparency? Because there must be a danger that companies will become less transparent if they're having to actually say what they're doing and why that is the right thing for them to do on modern slavery.
Well, certainly in the early discussions we've had with some very big brands off the record where they've been saying, well, we're doing a lot more than we're allowed to say in our statement. We are global entities and there are certain things we cannot say in our statement for the UK because we will be held accountable for it in a different country. There is already a reticence to put down exactly what is happening within the statement. And we at Discoport view a statement as just the tip of the iceberg. It is a statement of intent. But we fully expect that the evidence can be happening not necessarily as open data, but as shared data potentially behind closed doors. And these things can be evidence. Rather than expect that the statement covers everything, we expect that behaviours and actions that are placed in there are evidence in a far greater detail and live. The issue around transparency has been, from what we can see, a big disconnect between the corporate head, which is the board and the one that deals with finances, and the corporate heart, as in its people, the ones who are having to deliver. And also because there are many directors who feel that they're always the last to know about something that happens to people in their company. So once we enable these directors to see what's happening using transparency data, I think actually that will improve the due diligence approach. So it's the other way around. Rather than looking at a due diligence approach and its impact on transparency, it will be the other way.
What's a trend that you're seeing now that you want to see more of over the next 2 to 3 years?
when we first started, we naively thought that people were going to share their supply chains and we would make the world an open, fairer, greater place you could see everything that was going on. What's more interesting is that more have come to us and said, well, actually, whilst we cannot share our supply chains on your system, we do want to be able to use that data. So even though we give away a fair amount for free in order to improve the visibility into supply chains, many companies have said, we want a commercial relationship with you where we can make use of the good data that you've got, but it doesn't make our company nervous about what's out there. So the trend is transparency behind closed doors, which is kind of ironic, but it does enable us to influence behavior and also track behavior from the outside, even though there are certain things that will always be sensitive.
So lots of exciting things happen, and undoubtedly there'll be trends in transparency that we wouldn't have thought of yet, but it's clearly there's a lot of exciting things that businesses are doing to be more transparent and disclose on their modern slavery and forced labor issues. And thank you, Jaya Chakrabarty, for taking us through some of the most important trends.
You are very welcome. Thank you, Ian.